Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Monday, March 18th, 2013 will come to order. Senator Sparks, why don't you get us started? Senate File 960, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing Senate File 960, Public Housing Rehabilitation Bond Issue and Appropriation. Senate File 960 is a capital investment bill requesting $35 million in housing infrastructure bonds and $15 million in GO bonds for public housing preservation. The housing infrastructure bonds will be used to rehabilitate, stabilize, or construct privately owned affordable housing. The GO bonds will be used to address health and safety issues, to replace and repair major systems, and for energy conservation measures for public housing units. There's a great need for affordable housing, and the demand for the MFHA assistance goes beyond its resources. Senate File 960 will address affordable housing infrastructure needs in communities throughout the state, and now is the time to do this. Interest rates are low, and the construction industry is still recovering from the economic downturn. Mr. Chair and members, I know we have a full agenda, and I do have a couple testifiers, so if it's okay with you, I'd like to turn it over to them to discuss Senate File 960 in a little more detail.
Okay, who wants to go first? Just introduce yourself for the record and come start your testimony.
My name is Andrew Michelson. Thank you, Chairman Tomasoni and members of the committee. As I said, I'm Andrew Michelson. I'm the Director of New Business Development for Common Bond Communities. Common Bond Communities is the Midwest's largest nonprofit provider of affordable housing with services and has served the region for over 40 years. Our portfolio includes more than 5,000 affordable rental apartments and townhomes throughout 50 cities in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. Over 4,000 of these homes are in Minnesota. Close to 8,300 people, families, seniors, individuals with disabilities, and households experiencing homelessness call Common Bond home. We have kept an unwavering commitment to not only provide affordable homes, but necessary services and support that help residents achieve stability in their housing, advance in school and work, and prevent hospitalization and early nursing home placement. Common Bond has almost 500 units of supportive housing in its portfolio and continues to develop new units and to preserve existing units in communities because we are committed to helping Minnesota achieve its plan to end long-term homelessness and because we know supportive housing is a proven success strategy to do this. In particular, I would like to highlight two supportive housing projects currently in development that have been made possible through housing infrastructure bonds. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs selected Common Bond to develop affordable housing for veterans experiencing homelessness on the VA Medical Center campuses in St. Cloud and at Fort Snelling. In total, we will create 93 new units, 35 of which will be new construction in St. Cloud, and 58 that will be created through renovation of existing historic properties at Fort Snelling. These new housing communities will serve individual veterans as well as veteran families, including those with children, and will be dignified, respectful, and safe housing with supportive services for men and women who have served our country yet have been unable to find stable, affordable, and permanent housing. I'd like to direct your attention to the Fort Snelling project to illustrate the work we have planned. Fort Snelling project will include the preservation of five historically significant buildings dating from the turn of the 20th century. Once an integral part of the military operations at the upper post of Fort Snelling, these buildings now sit in a state of disrepair following decades of neglect and abandonment. Our project will restore these buildings to their former glory, preserving the historic and cultural significance, as well as updating building infrastructure to accommodate modern, dignified housing and ensuring their endurance for future generations. In the set of images that have been circulated, you can see an example of the decayed building condition of the buildings as they currently stand, with brick missing, windows broken, and roof slates crumbling. We've also included a rendering of those same buildings once construction is complete, where we've illustrated the repairs of the buildings, construction of a new lobby and central entry point, and other general improvements. The Fort Snelling and St. Cloud projects work directly toward the goal of eliminating homelessness, but neither would be moving forward without the housing infrastructure bonds awarded last October. Those funds have closed the capital funding gap and have leveraged an additional $12.4 million in private and philanthropic investment to make these projects a reality. In short, because of the investment Minnesota has made in housing across the state, 93 veterans and their families will soon be homeless no more. On behalf of Common Bond Communities, I encourage you to continue to create housing for all and to support Senate File 960. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Michelson? Okay. Move on then to Mr. Dannon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Stone.
Sorry. We don't have your name on the report.
That's okay. Right. I'm the director of the Minnesota program of CSH.
That's one of the reasons I always say introduce yourself for the record, because then I get it wrong and then I look dumb. But anyway, go ahead.
I didn't know I was going to be here either. Okay. So. Mr. Chair. But thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Senate File 960. CSH is a national nonprofit that uses housing solutions to improve the lives of the most vulnerable people in communities across the country and supported the creation of supportive housing here in Minnesota since 1993. I'm here today to address two of the components of the bill, both the housing infrastructure bonds as well as the GO bonds for the rehab of public housing. Since Andrew did such a great job talking about supportive housing, I'll keep those comments very brief. Supportive housing is a proven successful strategy to end long-term homelessness. After cycling through extensive public systems, people maintain housing stably through supportive housing. The costs are offset by the reductions in emergency expenditures due to reduced uses of jails, emergency rooms, detox facilities, and others. Supportive housing combines affordable housing with the needed support services to keep folks stably housed. And last year, I had the pleasure of meeting with this committee to talk about the bonding request that would move forward for the housing infrastructure bonds. I know there were several questions about whether or not there was indeed a need, whether or not those projects were ready to proceed, and if we would be able to use the money if appropriated. In fact, I'm pleased to say that we have, and all of those dollars have been awarded to projects throughout the state. Supportive housing and homelessness is not just an issue for the metro area. We've worked on projects, and I believe a couple of different maps were passed out earlier showing the various locations throughout the state. Just to name a few, Conifer Estates is located in Bemidji, Minnesota, and currently under construction. It was built as part of bonding proceeds from previous years, and it created 20 units of families and single households. Other projects on that map include Gateway Gardens in Moorhead, Perpich Apartments in Hibbing, Dreamcatcher Homes in Ogama, and Silver Creek Corner in Rochester. Supportive housing is all over the state, and the need is great. On behalf of our partners, our many partners who work for public housing authorities, I just want to say a few words about the GO bonds. Minnesota's 21,000 public housing units provide homes for more than 36,000 low-income residents. Residents of our public housing units tend to be our oldest and our youngest citizens. A significant number, approximately 12,000, are children, and even larger number are senior citizens. Over 65% of the households living in public housing have incomes less than $15,000 per year. Our public housing units are aging, and they are showing their age. More than 90% of Minnesota's public housing units are over 20 years old, and more than one half of these units are in excess of 35. Local housing authorities operate on a very slim margin. Resources are used to cover operating costs and carry out routine maintenance. These agencies do not have a flow of revenue, which is sufficient to cover the major repairs or rehabilitation projects. Types of projects that would be addressed with state public housing rehabilitation funds include major roof repair, window replacement, boilers, HVAC systems, handicap accessibility, plumbing, and more. This bonding request is in the amount of $15 million for 2013 and will extend the life of many units operating with a patchwork of repairs. I mentioned supportive housing is my primary issue and my primary area of expertise. However, I did willingly step in to provide testimony for the issue around the GO bonds for public housing because of a personal perspective I have. Briefly, would just like to share that I am a lifelong resident of Minnesota. My mother was raised in an area of St. Paul called Sweet Hollow, which in the 50s was raised for health concerns. My father was brought up in a community called Rondo, which was displaced by the introduction of Highway 94. Housing has always been an important issue in my family. I personally was born and raised not too far away from here in public housing, Mount Airy community, just behind Regents Hospital. My parents raised myself and my five siblings until such time as we could buy our own house, the home that my mom still lives in today in St. Paul. And as a result of the opportunities that we were given, I'm pleased to say that four of the six of the kids, we've all gone to college. Five of us have all become homeowners living here in Minnesota. And I just would love to see future and further generations be given the same opportunities that affordable, stable housing gave my family and me. So thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions I can.
Very, very nice story. I appreciate that. I'm just going to have Mr. Jensen explain the two different types of bonds that are in this bill so everybody understands what this is all about. And maybe if you look on the page one on line 1.8, there's an exact language for $30 million, and then the new language is $35 million. And maybe an update on that $30 million, if it's all been spent already and accounted for, if somebody knows that. I don't know if anybody knows that or not, but anyway, go ahead, Mr. Jensen, and just explain the two different bonds that are in here.
Mr. Chairman, members, my understanding is that $35 million would be an additional bond issue, and that would be what we call appropriation bonds, where the Housing Finance Agency sells their bonds, and the state pays for the debt service from the general fund. And that's found on page 2, lines 26, is where we make the transfer from the general fund to pay for the debt service on the appropriation bonds. On page 2, section 3, these are general obligation bonds, and these count against the debt capacity of the state. They are also paid for from the general fund, whereas those appropriation bonds do not count against the capacity of the state.
And Senator Sparks, I don't know if you know this or if somebody can help us out on line 2.26, maybe Mr. Jensen can help us. The number is blank there, and do we need to put a number in now, or is that something we determine later?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we would determine that later. I think this bill would go to the bonding committee, and we would determine how much general fund payment there would come with whatever number you authorize.
And do any of the witnesses know, has the $30 million in subdivision 2 on line 1.8, has that all been issued?
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Somebody who knows.
No, I'm sneaking in here. My name is Darielle Dannon, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the Homes for All campaign. So we're some of the folks who have been working on this along with the agency. And I know that the agency is here, but we did touch base with them ahead of time. And so those $30 million worth of bonds, which we approved, have the RFP went out and the funding has been awarded. I think they're in the process of actually issuing the bonds. But yes, essentially all the dollars are out the door. In fact, you'll find it interesting to note that we authorized that Minnesota Housing would issue $30 million worth of bonds. They actually leveraged that along with federal dollars and other philanthropic resources into $134 million. And that'll end up impacting 3,100 households. So that's what we would anticipate a similar thing would be happening with this issuance of bonds.
Are there any questions from the committee? Any comments? Senator Rood?
Mr. Chair, and I don't know who would like to answer this, but one of my concerns with this, and I'm hoping that it's addressed on Section 1, in Crow Wing County, I think you can see that we have a large amount of foreclosures, and a lot of the foreclosures are the old railroad homes. And so when they go into foreclosure, it's old housing stock. And so is there a criteria for rehabbing homes? Because I think at some point that there is the life of the home has it's time for it to go. And I hate to see us rehabbing old homes where we put in families who then cannot afford the heating costs or the electricity or and so is there a criteria in here for rehabbing homes? I would hate to see that money going into homes that have really reached their lifetime.
Ms. Dannon, do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, I'd hate to speak for the agency, but I know that my organization, we work with many of the nonprofits who do the work on the ground, and we spend an awful lot of time figuring out what those standards are. And so I know there are standards, and they're actually quite high. although I do know that they involve a lot of work with local communities as to sort of determining what gets chosen as, in this instance, it would be land trust homes. So what gets chosen to become a land trust home or rehabbed and then sold back on the market. But it's always tricky in foreclosures because we certainly have a lot of others who are not part of, you know, Minnesota Housing or those good nonprofits out there also rehabbing homes to sort of subpar standard. I know we sort of all of our communities struggle with that.
Mr. Chair,
I
thank you for that. I think we've seen a lot of community partners leverage these dollars, and actually in my community, working with various partners to take down those homes that need to go, and then we end up with a parcel that has water and sewer and infrastructure, and we can then put a home back on that to make a really good parcel instead of rehabbing something that maybe should not have. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Darren, I think I heard you say that you leveraged the $30 million into $130 million and that it impacted 3,000-some households. Mr. Chair, I was asking Ms. Darren a question.
Oh, Ms. Darren.
Thank you, Senator. So $30 million was leveraged into $134 million, and that ended up impacting 3,100 households, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, so they must be doing pretty extensive renovation because that's over $40,000 a house. Am I thinking about that properly?
Ms. Darren.
Senator, it's always tricky when we're talking about, so some of this is, it's a blending of, we've, and I don't want to speak actually for the agency because I know they are here, but when we talk about per unit costs, I know this is a combination of both single family homes that we're renovating, we're building new, it's multifamily housing, it's foreclosure recovery, and then it's supportive housing. So there are many, many different kinds of uses that we're using these dollars for, so it ends up being sort of an average. But I think it is just, again, good to note that it was $30 million, and that was sort of leveraged into that $134 million. And so some of those, yes, are a little bit more expensive units to build.
Does you want to comment?
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Katie Topinka. I'm with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And Ms. Dannon is correct. It's sort of it depends on what type of redevelopment was done. So some is pretty substantial rehabilitation. Some is preservation work. Some is acquisition and rehabilitation of foreclosed properties. And so those leverage numbers, we can get you more specifics on different projects if you'd like to see those, Senator Scoy and members. It depends on kind of the extent of the project and what needs to be done that determines the per unit cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when you're buying or acquiring a substandard foreclosed house and then fixing it up and putting it back on the market, would you be showing me the net then, which would be the cost you put into the purchase and the renovation minus the sale?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, that's what we would be able to show you.
Great. I'd like to see that. Thank you.
And then the person who moves in, are they responsible for the entire sale cost, or what are they responsible for? Or is there, it depends on each situation is different, I imagine. But
sure. Mr. Chair, it will depend. So we have a number of community land trusts who are involved with some of the acquisition and rehabilitation. So they actually own the land, and then the homeowner would be responsible for the home itself. And then in other cases, there are other organizations that maybe would do the acquisition and rehab and then sell it to a homeowner that meets certain income qualifications. So it could depend on the nonprofit that is involved in the work and kind of how their program works. But we could certainly provide you with some different examples.
And does any of this money go into, like, apartment-type complexes that the person just ends up renting?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's a substantial part of the money. In fact, I think it was, I'll double-check this number and verify, but it was about $27 million of the bond proceeds from last year that went to rental housing. So a substantial amount of it went to rental housing.
And in the form of renovations?
Mr. Chair, it was a mix of renovations and new construction and rehabilitation. And so the organizations that receive the bond proceeds agree to keep the rental housing affordable because they've been the recipient of the proceeds. So it's affordable rental housing.
Any other questions? Okay. If not, then Senator Sparks will lay Senate File 960 over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Is Senator Cohen here or Senator Bonhoff?
Cohen, sir.
Huh?
Cohen is here.
He just walked in. Senator Cohen.
Yeah, we liked it.
It's your first appearance this year in this committee, Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm honored.
We're honored to have you as a former member. Which bill would you like to do first?
What would you like?
It's up to you. We got three of them on the Senate file, 531, 882, and 937. So you pick.
How about if we start with 937, the Ordway proposal?
Okay, that works. Ordway Center for the Performing Arts.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 937 is a request for the continuation of the Ordway. We've provided some significant help for the Ordway proposal. What is being done is the Sample Arts Partnership, which was formed several years ago, and Ms. Mitchell, who is the president of the Ordway, will offer a little bit more testimony. But the Ordway is a building that obviously makes a huge difference, not simply to St. Paul, but to the state. And I will bet, and I know the Ordway has done this and has the information on attendance throughout from people throughout the state of Minnesota, throughout the region. But what's happened over the years is where the building was initially envisioned, and if members recall, the building opened, I think, in 1985. And what was envisioned by the Ordway family is that it would be utilized by the major arts organizations. And things have changed in terms of the economics of the building, so that obviously a lot of the significant touring productions have utilized the Ordway. And in the process, some other parts of what had been the intent of the Ordway get squeezed. For instance, the Chamber Orchestra, as a notable example. You know, if you've got the Chamber Orchestra performing once their contract is settled, and if they're performing on a regular basis, there's just so much space to then have other kinds of productions. And so the decision was made to do a couple of things. One, to take the smaller McKnight Theater next to the major theater at the Ordway, and to enlarge it so that would be the home base for the Chamber Orchestra and the Schubert Club, and then to continue to use the main stage for opera, but also to have it more available for the other kinds of events that take place. Certainly in St. Paul, the existence of the Ordway coupled with the Science Museum and with the hockey arena has been a huge economic driver for obviously the city of St. Paul, but for the state of Minnesota as well. The other important piece of the Ordway proposal, which is not in front of, which is not part of this bill, is that there will be the significant increase in an endowment fund, which will be of supplemental help to the Ordway and to its resident arts organizations. The Ordway has been quite successful in achieving a very significant private participation. This in no way substitutes for the private dollars, but provides some supplemental help to get it over the hump to get this thing finished. So that's kind of an overview, and Ms. Mitchell can offer more detail about what the proposal is.
Welcome, Ms. Mitchell, and just say your name for the record.
Patricia Mitchell, the president and CEO of the Ordway.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you, Senator Cohen. It's a pleasure to be here. I come not just as the president of the Ordway, but also as the treasurer of the Arts Partnership, which, as Senator Cohen mentioned, is a formal alliance of the organizations that are the principal users of the Ordway. The Ordway itself, because we program theater, music, world music, dance, and have a comprehensive education program, the Chamber Orchestra, the Minnesota Opera, and the Schubert Club. The four organizations have come together in what is really a unique joint problem-solving expedition to solve the two problems that have plagued the Ordway really since the beginning. They're the problems of success, which is that there is more activity, more demand for activity than can be accommodated by the calendar of what we call the music theater, the large space which many of you are familiar with. There is a smaller theater, the McKnight, a lovely little theater of 300 seats, which, although lovely, is very underutilized because of the size. So in order to free up time in the schedule of the music theater, the decision was taken by the partners to convert the McKnight into a concert hall. And if you, we have to have visual aids. If you turn to this brochure, you'll see. This is a photograph of the way the Ordway looks now. This is the music theater with the Marzatelli foyer, which you're familiar with. And this is the McKnight, which some of you may have been in, others not. But if you lift the magic flap, you'll see how it will look when the McKnight is replaced by a concert hall. The thing that is important, one thing that's important to know about the concert hall is that although it is envisioned as the downtown home of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, the Chamber Orchestra actually will only use approximately half the time in the concert hall. There are many, many, many music organizations in the metro area and beyond who have expressed interest in making that concert hall their home. So the service that is provided by this new facility is not only to the Chamber Orchestra, but to other organizations in Minnesota. As Senator Cohen alluded to, the economic impact of the Ordway and the other organizations in downtown St. Paul is well known. And again, having to have visual aids, we have a handout that demonstrates the economic impact of the on downtown St. Paul of the Ordway in 1985. The concert hall, we estimate, will have an additional economic impact in terms of the dollars that will be spent by the audiences that will come to the new hall. There will be upwards of 120,000 people there when the hall is completely up and running. And the economic impact of their attendance in parking and restaurants and other activity is estimated to be somewhere over $6 million additional impact to downtown St. Paul. But it's very important to think, too, of the impact that the Ordway and its arts partners have on the state. And that brings me to my favorite visual aid, which is this map. And this really does demonstrate that the Ordway and the arts partners are a statewide resource. My favorite color dots on here are the blue ones. Those are the Ordway dots. The dots demonstrate where the arts partners provide service through to the state, either through touring or, in the case of the Ordway, by bringing students from all over the state to the special student performances that we do at the Ordway. And the yellow circles indicate the broadcast area of the programs of the opera, the Schubert Club, and the Chamber Orchestra that are carried for free throughout the state by Minnesota Public Radio. This year, the Ordway will serve 50,000 school children in performances by professional international artists. The students come after lots of study guides and preparatory work with their teachers to the Ordway for performances by these artists. 50,000 of them this year. The tickets are a smart $3.50, and the Ordway actually provides the busing. So a student who's coming from the far northwest corner is paying $3.50 for a ticket to see an artist of the stature of this year, the dance company Palabolas, a wonderful Latina ranchero singer named Lila Downs, artists of every stripe. For $3.50, and the Ordway pays $480 for the bus that will bring them downtown. One of the advantages of our project is that it will allow the Ordway to expand its service to students. It will enable us to reach up to another 30,000 students through these student performances. Because the reason we don't do more now is not because there are not more students, and it's not even because there's not more money. It's because there is no time in the theater to provide these wonderful performances to the school children of our state. So there are a myriad of benefits to this project. The economic impact to St. Paul, the statewide impact of all the arts activity, the very direct impact on the students of our state. We are, all of us at the Arts Partnership, extremely grateful to the legislature and the governor for the help you have already given to this project. And as Senator Cohen says, an additional amount will help us bring the project in at the highest possible level of quality. And we are very excited about the opportunity. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Cohen and testifier, the campaign or the concert hall, is that when you say half the time would be the chamber orchestra and what would be some examples of some other organizations that would be performing?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we have had two meetings with about 35 music organizations who have expressed interest in using the concert hall. Most specifically last week with Vocal Essence, which is an organization some of you may know, an organization called Contus, the male a cappella ensemble. So there's a lot, and now, because the word of the concert hall has sort of been in the pipeline, now artists are starting to call us saying, when will we know? When will we have the schedule? So I think we can anticipate use by a wide variety of organizations, not necessarily all from the metro.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Ms. Mitchell, I think Sarah Saxog in particular would like to know if there's room for Trampled by Turtles.
Senator,
you want to shut me up, don't you?
We would love to have Trampled by Turtles. 1,100 seats, which is the capacity of the concert hall, would not be enough. However, in the music theater, 1,900 seats, we would be delighted.
So
the answer is no.
No, the answer.
The answer is absolutely.
Well, not enough. 1,100 is not enough.
But Mr. Chairman, Ms. Mitchell also suggests the major music theater, which is 1,900.
That's enough. So this is a very interesting bonding bill, Senator Cohen. Is it? So I think if I understand it, all the pre-design and design are all done, and you just need a little bit more money. Is that the deal?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and that's not been unusual. There have been a number of instances in the legislature where we've done things more at the back end than the front end. Children's Theater is a notable example of that. Our Children's Theater, Children's Museum, also had support at the back end. There's a major request from St. Paul for the Children's Museum, but both the Children's Theater and the Children's Museum had legislative support at the back end. So this is very similar to that.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, you mentioned the hockey arena and what a success it is, and I have to agree. I actually visited it twice myself last week and enjoyed the Minnesota Wild immensely in that location, and I can see what an asset that is to St. Paul downtown. My question is, I'm sure there's some place that you, with the studies, and I don't know who wants to answer this, but parking's going to be an issue. If you're going to have more people coming there, you're going to have more parking. We all know what downtown parking in St. Paul can be. Has that been addressed at all in your, I didn't see it in here anywhere.
I think Ms. Mitchell's on the committee that has been involved with that.
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, by actual count, according to the City of St. Paul, there are sufficient parking spaces for these extra seats, which is an additional 800 seats. We are also hopeful with the light rail that many of our patrons will come on the light rail and many patrons of the XL will as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. Then we will lay Senate File 937 on the table for possible inclusion and recommendation to the Bonding Committee. Thank you. Which one do you want to do next, Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, you've got
St. Paul Public TV or Minnesota Museum?
Sure, Senate File 531, which is the public television proposal. And I realize this is kind of my arts culture day. I'm kind of out of my normal, the kind of stuff I normally do around here, so I realize it's a little bit out of character for me to do this. But
Senator. Just,
what is your character?
Normally, I like to do a lot of Northeastern economic development.
There, I was wondering.
I have that reputation.
Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm assuming Senator Cohen has got a fiscal note attached to this as well, so that's been certainly in his... In his life before, we always had that, but I'm just joking.
It is right here.
That's the
yeah, exactly. And this is a, Mr. Chairman and members, this is a $9 million request for TPT. Obviously, known to everybody. And certainly, this is something I try to emphasize when I have these efforts as to what the impact is beyond simply the geography of my city. TPT happens to be located in St. Paul, but obviously everybody at this table knows that absent the existence of public television, the state of Minnesota would not have access to television programming of the sort done by TPT. And so this is an effort to provide renovation and construction of their building. I have Mr. Straczynski and Ms. Schmidt who can offer direct testimony on what they would like to do.
Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm a government affairs consultant for Twin Cities Public Television. Thank you for this opportunity here today, and thank you, Senator Cohen, for bringing this bill forward. I just want to share with the committee members, public television in Minnesota, two things. First of all, public television in Minnesota is... every home can reach get a public television signal. Public television in Minnesota, as well as the country, was started in the 40s by Congress, where they said reserve these frequencies for the public to have access to the media, so they always have a chance to talk and free flow of information and share ideas. Many states, public television is owned by government. It's owned by the state government. In your surrounding states, it's owned by state government. Minnesota chose the path of partnering with communities in order to have a public television signal. And that's important to understand. In the long run, it's been a lot cheaper for Minnesota to do that because we're in our communities also raising dollars and everything else to support the kinds of programs we do. And in fact, public television has been supported by the state of Minnesota in bonding bills going back at least to the 70s when I was doing some of these things in the administration department. So it's a long-standing tradition. And in this particular bill, it's a 50% match, so that's really important as well. So instead of the taxpayers being on the hook for 100%, it's a 50% match. Mr. Chairman, I also just want to quickly tell you that I appreciate the fact to be here. I think 27 or 28 years ago, I was in front of a similar committee asking for money to build this original facility. When we moved it from the state fairgrounds downtown St. Paul, it was a very big deal. But now we have some major issues that need to be addressed, and I'll turn it over to Jennifer Schmidt. Thank you.
Thank you. Say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Schmidt, and I am the CFO of Twin Cities Public Television. Thank you, Senator Cohen, for authoring this important bill. I'm grateful for the opportunity to provide you all with some information about Senate File 531, which is requesting matching funds to expand and renovate our current facility located in Lower Town in St. Paul, just across the street from the Union Depot and at the terminus of the new light rail that will connect Minneapolis and St. Paul, and just blocks away from the new ballpark being built. Twin Cities Public Television wants to be a part of the rebirth and revitalization, to be a visible part of the neighborhood, and to create a destination for people from all over Minnesota to come to. Our 82,000 square foot facility has been located in St. Paul for nearly 25 years. And from the time the first shovel broke ground to build Channel 2, we have enjoyed a strong partnership with the state of Minnesota. The state made an investment to help build the original facility, and from that investment, we leveraged charitable giving from the private sector to complete the construction. I'm pleased to say that today, we already have the money in the bank to begin renovation of the facility if you support this request this session. We began fundraising for this project over 3 years ago, and we have raised a standard 50% in matching funds. We have already invested over $500,000 with our architects. We've completed the schematic design development, and about 75% of the construction documents. We will be shovel-ready if funded and are ready and anxious to break ground and start working. The project has three objectives. First, there is some much-needed maintenance that we have to do to protect ours and your original investment. We need new and more energy-efficient HVAC systems and a new roof, just to name a couple. We also are needing to complete the final phases of converting our facility to being fully digital, upgrading our technical plant. The second objective is to renovate and expand our public safety spaces. We want to literally open our doors to the public. And if you will now, I will walk you through some highlights in the booklet that we provided for you. Starting on page 3, on the top of the page, you will see the exterior of our current building on the corner of 4th and Sibley. Standing outside our building today, you'll likely experience 4th Street as a dark, infrequently used corridor with little connection between the exterior of the building and the vibrancy of the media world within. On the bottom of page 3, you'll notice some distinctive changes we intend to deliver. The wall of windows facing the children's park will connect the interior and exterior of the building, allowing daylight to enter the building and also allowing light to shine from the interior of the building onto the park and the street. On the street level, we will create an obvious entry to the public skyway system and an inviting entryway for visitors. All of the glass ground roof will provide the public with a glimpse into the media world inside the building. An even more dramatic change is highlighted on page 5. You'll see that there's really a hidden gem today within the TPT building. There's actually a street-level space that is unfinished today, and we intend to finish that. We'll turn the space into a very large, informal, flexible, and ever-changing lobby. 25 years ago, television was produced almost exclusively within the walls of a studio and broadcast to a passive audience of observers. Technology has evolved. Leveraging media on air, online, and on the ground, we are now able to provide an interactive experience to an audience of active participants. Our new lobby will showcase this experience with informational kiosks, on-demand programming, an exhibit space connecting TPT with the community. This new public space will be a gathering place for a variety of events. On pages 6, 7, and 8, you see three different examples of how this space will be used.
Before you go, how did this room get like this?
Mr. Chairman, it's unfinished, and what it actually has become is a storage space.
Looks like my garage. Anyway.
There's no cars down there.
Mr. Chair, just want to let you know, TPT used to be my former employer, and I have never been to that room because it's so dark.
You're a smart man. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. On page 9, you're actually going to see both the current and the future Skyway level entrance to TPT. This area will become a vibrant and open space that clearly signifies media. It will create ample space for large audiences to gather before a production. The walls of our studio will come down and be replaced by glass, allowing visitors to view a live rehearsal or production. The small overhead televisions will be replaced by a large video wall that will show the best of PBS and TPT programming. Again, connecting TPT with the community, this area will be enjoyed by people moving through the Skyway to and from the Union Depot, as well as our guests inside the facility. Finally, as evening approaches on page 10, the newly lit street entry and beacon will be casting light and positive energy onto 4th and Sibley, adding safety and security on our corner. The third objective of our remodel and expansion is to increase the capacity of our office space. We are so fortunate to have been adding jobs at TPT. Over the past 5 years, our staff has increased by 21% from 173 to 210 employees. We are very excited about this opportunity and hope you will support us this session. Our donors are excited to see us get going, and I'm afraid if we do not begin construction soon, we will lose some of this investment. We're ready to go and would greatly appreciate your support. I'm now happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Are there any questions? Senator Cohen, Council suggests an addition to the language here. Go ahead, Dave, tell them why.
Mr. Chairman, members, I understand part of this would be owned by a nonprofit corporation, and we usually use the section of the statutes that cover state bonds in used for nonprofit organizations. So on line 4.1 after St. Paul, we would insert subject to Minnesota statutes 16A.695.
So line 1.11 after St. Paul before the period. So Senator Hur would move that language.
Mr. Chairman, members, we've done this for the Children's Museum and a number of projects in Minneapolis also. It's kind of the standard boilerplate language.
Okay. Any questions, anybody? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Szczesinski.
If I could just finally say, I want everybody to please understand, though, this is a statewide effort. Twin Cities Public Television brings in national productions into locally. They do a lot of the legacy productions as well. But TPT also provides the Minnesota channel. They staff it. They manage that channel, and that goes out to all public television stations. So it's really benefiting everybody, like the legislative coverage, a lot of the legacy programming. This goes to everybody. Finally, I think as your constituents come to the Capitol to visit, it'd be appropriate in the future to bring schools and whatever. They certainly can go down to Twin Cities Public Television and watch productions being made. I think it's another opportunity for them as well to learn a lot about public television and the good things that we do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Okay. Seeing none, Senator Cohen will lay over Senate File 531 for possible inclusion in the recommendation to the Bonding Committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you.
And Senate File 930. No. No, 882, I'm sorry, 882.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 882 is a new request for myself. I've authored legislation in the past for Twin Cities Public Television and the Ordway.
Pretty small one. Did you leave a zero out here?
Did you cover this yourself?
Just wanted to warm up the committee a little bit, Mr. Chairman. So this is a request for pre-design and development. And this is for the Minnesota Museum of American Art. And it's an organization that has been in existence for a number of years, but without a home. Minnesota Museum of American Art has a collection of, I think, 4,000 to 5,000 pieces. They have had exhibitions in the Landmark Center, in the building across from City Hall in St. Paul, but have not had a permanent home. And they've reached a level where they have a significant number of works that are non-Minnesota works, American art from the 19th and 20th century. Additionally, another significant part of their collection is Minnesota art. And so there's no museum quite like that in the Twin Cities. Obviously, the MIA and Walker have significant collections, have not really specialized in Minnesota art. So the effort by Ms. McCollum, who's the executive director and the board of directors, is to try to put together a permanent home. Obviously, they understand that in making this request to the legislature that there is the private match, as has always been required with these kinds of efforts. They have several areas or several places that they think would be appropriate, but they would like to begin the process to finally achieve a home for what would be a significant permanent museum. Members, again, possibly have seen some of their collection in their temporary homes, but this is the first time that they have been in a position to make the request for a permanent home. So Ms. McCollum, who's the executive director, can offer more detail in terms of where they are in the process and what the particular request is to the state legislature.
Welcome, Ms. McCollum. Just say your name for the record and go ahead and come in.
Thank you. I'm Kristen McCollum, executive director of the Minnesota Museum of American Art. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. Thank you to Senator Cohen for introducing this bill. The Minnesota Museum of American Art is seeking funding for pre-design for reestablishing the Minnesota Museum of American Art in St. Paul. This pre-design funding would be pivotal in realizing our goal of occupying a permanent home in St. Paul. Our desired location is in the Pioneer Endicott Building in the edge of Lower Town in St. Paul, which is right on the future Central Corridor light rail line in the corner of 4th and Robert Streets. A renewed Minnesota Museum of American Art would be a powerful cultural destination along the future light rail line, attracting residents and visitors from across the state in the revitalization of this rich cultural and economic area in Minnesota. We would also draw creative people to invest in the economy and life of our state and create jobs and a visitor base that will stimulate our state's economy in addition to that. The Minnesota Museum of American Art is the only Minnesota art museum that truly reflects a statewide mission. Our focus is in exhibiting, supporting, and encouraging art and artists in Minnesota in the wider context of American art. We have, you might remember us as the St. Paul Gallery and School of Art a long time ago, the St. Paul Art Center, the Minnesota Museum of Art. We've had many, many names over the years, but we've always been dedicated to the art and artists of our region, to art education in the state of Minnesota and in the metropolitan area, to community interaction and to cultural cross-fertilization within the state of Minnesota. We've been traveling exhibitions from our renowned collection of over 4,000 works of art to locations throughout the state in the past few years and even in many years before that. And we've excited new audiences recently in Duluth, St. Peter, Northfield, and the Fargo-Moorhead area. We have a strong representation of art of Native American artists in our community, and to that end, we are traveling a large retrospective of one of our Native artists, George Morrison, which will open in the Fargo-Moorhead area in June. We appreciate your consideration of this request for pre-design in reestablishing the Minnesota Museum of American Art in St. Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Now, if you have any questions, I'll be free to answer those.
Are there any questions? Do you have something for this? Okay. Senator Cohen, we need to add that same language to this one.
Yes.
So on line 1.9 after St. Paul, for the period, insert subject to Minnesota statutes, comma, section 16A.695. So, Senator Herr will make that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Any further comment or questions on Senate File 882? Seeing none, we'll lay this over then to Senator Cohen for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Chairman members, thanks for listening to me. Thank you.
Senator Bonoff, are you around?
There
you are. You have two bills. Which one would you like to do first?
We're going to do the Film and TV Board first. Senate File 352.
Go ahead. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 352 is our attempt at jump-starting the film and TV industry in Minnesota. We have a long-standing tradition of having strong film industry production in Minnesota. In fact, we were one of the first states to have an original snowbait rebate that brought many folks to Minnesota, and we can all think of the movies that have been done here over the years. But in fact, we stopped funding that in 2002, and then that activity dried up because it is competitive, and those folks go where they can actually make money to make those films. And so I will let my testifier, Lucinda Winter, talk about the history of that production in Minnesota. And so what I will do is just briefly review the bill. The bill
Senator Bonoff, why are you carrying this and not Senator Cohen?
Well, so here's the reason, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, being, you know, chair of finance, was willing to let me carry it. My son is in the film business. He works in California for CAA, and I want that boy back here.
I thought he worked in the White House.
That's my other son.
Oh, okay, all right.
So I want at least one of them here. And so I'm looking to make sure I do what I can as a mom to have a growing and explosive film industry in Minnesota so I get that boy back here. But just kidding. They did, but I am a big fan of that industry. And we have so much talent in Minnesota. You know, we have such a strong arts community, such strong theater, that we are the perfect place to be a mecca for film and theater. We have geography that we're known for around the country. You can be right in the heart of a city and then go just a short distance away and you're in rural America. So with this bill does is it puts forward $10 million to offer up as production credits. And it does it in a few different ways. We say that up to 25% of film production costs for films that locate production outside the metropolitan area. And within the metro area, we will give 25% of film production costs for films that spend more than $1 million in the metro area. If, in fact, a film is going to be less than $1 million, then we reduce that production credit to 20%. We really want to make sure we're giving incentives to those big productions to come to Minnesota. And before I say anything more, I would like to let Ms. Winter speak about this project. But also, Mr. Chair, just for members to think about that, we said as we campaigned in the last cycle that we were going to make our primary focus be about jobs and growing our economy. And so I have been doing all that I can to find places and policies and proposals that, in fact, do that. And so that is why I was also so pleased to carry this bill. Ms. Winter has a film, but I suggested that in the interest of time that you might prefer to just hear her testimony rather than also see her six-minute film, but that I'll leave that to the committee.
Does it work?
We have the technology, we believe, or else Ben is in big trouble if it doesn't play appropriately. So,
what's the committee's pleasure? Want to watch a movie? You all look bored, so might as well turn the movie on. Go ahead.
Okay, very good.
Turn off the lights, right?
Chairman normally supplies popcorn.
That would be good.
We've never done the lights before.
Here and also a lot of out-of-town companies that come in from the coasts and other places to look for locations here in Minnesota.
Everybody who works in entertainment sees a value here. We have what many states don't have, an infrastructure. We're set up to succeed.
In 1997, we were the first state in the country to offer an incentive. But it basically was an attempt to try to keep production from moving, shifting to Canada, because that was starting to happen. Now, if you look at a map of the United States, there are fewer than 10 states that are not offering some form of incentive.
You're competing with the states of Louisiana, New Mexico, Georgia, Ohio, Connecticut, who are all at least in the 25% to 35% range. If you want to increase your industry here, you have to get up in the 20 to 25% range.
One of the things that I do in my job is I create the budget, oftentimes from scratch. Then, part of, again, managing those resources is how you get the best value for whatever that money is that you have. Incentives and rebates are a huge part of that.
So production incentives have become the number one tool that production companies are using when they're assessing alternate locations for production. And if we want that business here, we have got to have some form of incentive, or we're just not in the game.
For Bizarre Foods, on an annual basis, we employ anywhere from 30 to 65, 70 people, majority from the state of Minnesota. We probably bring in revenue on an annual basis of anywhere from $4 to $4.5 million on that one show.
Our clients are basically advertising agencies. We usually employ about 30 to 40 people per day of shooting. We often shoot over multiple days.
The incentive program for us has helped us do a lot of things. I don't know that we would have been able to produce our very first project for television, which was very successful.
If we sell one cable series, that can mean several million dollars of revenue in the first season alone. So obviously, if that show is picked up for another season, sometimes three and four or five seasons, you're talking about keeping people employed over a long period of time at pretty good salaries.
We've grown significantly. We went from staff of four people. I believe we have 14 people on staff now, and that's not even including the crews that we use, the freelancers, the actors, all of those people.
And we have a lot of pressure from the networks to go elsewhere. And I think if there were tax incentives or rebates here in the state of Minnesota, it would be very, very easy decision to make to base that production here.
It's hard to state how important Snowbait is for any filmmaker trying to stay here and make and do good quality work. Can't do it without it.
There has been one film, After the Dawn, that was just filmed in Maple Lake a year or so ago. It was such a good opportunity for our community to kind of come together and enjoy being part of the film, but also it was a benefit to several of the businesses in town, giving them exposure because they were on camp, and also because money was spent in town.
The movie North Country was filmed here in the year 2004, in the middle of winter, which was a real great boom for business. I did more business in 4 weeks than I would have done in 2 months, I bet.
It was a boost in hours that continued and never dropped down, continued growing.
And from what I understand, the economic benefit was almost $5 million to our area, which is a pretty nice chunk of change.
I think it has a benefit for communities, and especially smaller communities that maybe we don't have any events come our way throughout the year.
And as a small town in the middle of two somewhat bigger towns, we need to get our main street back to life. We need to bring as much business into the community as possible.
Back in February of 2010, we had Greg Kinnear and Billy Crudup and Alan Arkin come to Minnesota, and they chose Hanover for a key location in their film. Just phenomenal to see that many people come to our city to help work. And it's one day. I would love to see 10 days. It's not disruptive at all to our community. Just a positive economic benefit.
You're bringing both the city to your community as well as dollars into your community. And any penny spent within your community and not somewhere else is a better penny spent.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator Bonner.
I thought they were pretty smart to have your communities featured in that film.
That was an Italian grocery store too. That they were.
That was good.
almost bribery, Mr. Chair.
there may be an amendment that does make it look like bribery, but
Chair, he says that like it's a bad thing.
I'm not commenting on that, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate that this bill, and having Snowbait will be a wonderful asset for filmmaker. My previous occupation was an independent producer. I know how much struggle independent filmmaker go through. Yeah. And I just like to suggest to the author to see if the senator will be interested to increase the rate a little higher than just 25%. And add on 5% on all three category. So that would be my suggestion. And also that I do have a question for Ms. Mitchell to see if are you comfortable with your outreach to independent filmmakers? Knowing that I know there's a recent movie in my community called Opposite Blood, and I think they spent close to $500,000 to make employ close to 100 people, very diverse, actors and casting, and it was screened at for 2 weeks. They had their premiere 2 weeks at Carmike Theater, and I'm not sure if they hear about Snowbait. Mm-hmm. So, if you can explain to us on that.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Lucinda Winter. I'm the executive director at Minnesota Film and TV, and I want to first off thank Senator Bonner for helping us get this bill heard and introduced and supporting it as she has. And I'd like to address your question, Senator, but I'll sort of wrap it into my remarks. Similar to public television, we have a number of core services at the Film Commission. We are the only film commission at the state level in the United States that's public-private. All others are a report to the governor, either through their deed or tourism, sometimes directly to the governor if you live in Texas. But we receive a state appropriation separate from this funding that is for our ops every year. And again, this year we've asked for $325,000. It's in the tourism budget. We have to match that with private funds. So we are a very entrepreneurial organization. And in 83, when we were established, it was with the understanding that if private industry supported our film commission and felt it necessary, that that the state government would also be supportive. So thank you for 30 years of support. It's very appreciated. Snowbait is a separate fund. It was created in 1997. General funds supported Snowbait from 97 to 2002. And in that time period, there was about $4 million. It was a much more modest incentive at that time. It was started at 5%, went to 10, started with just features, went to features and TV series, and was unfunded in 2002 when we were red penciling and trying to shore up a budget deficit. It was a very successful program with about a $4 million budget. Investment at that. In those years, there was about $52 million that came into the state in new production. When I came into my position in late 2005, we did not have funding for Snowbait, so my first job was to come to the Capitol and ask for some funding, because it had become very clear at that time that not only Canada was in the game in a serious, serious way, but all these other states that you can see on your plastic map, they have come on board too. The only states that do not offer some form of incentive are the white states. There are two flavors of incentive in the production. One is a tax credit, and one is a rebate. A rebate is a check that was received by the production company. They have to be certified by our office before they begin production. At the end of production, when the economic activity has occurred, we verify that economic activity. We either do a review of the financials in our office if it's a small film, and that means looking at every receipt over $25. So there's a full-time person who does this. Or if it's over $1 million, we have an independent auditor who looks at this. So no state investment is made in a production until the activity occurs. That is, and so to answer your question, Senator, if we, at 25%, a rebate is as valuable to a producer as a 30% tax credit. And the reason for that is because you're always going to pay some points when you transfer or sell your tax credit, which is what these guys do. So they could pay anywhere between 3 and 7% to a broker. Sometimes it's a bank. There are private brokers to sell those credits. And sometimes you have to sit there for 2 or 3 years to sell those credits out. So there's a time value of money. A rebate is clean. We have control. It gives us complete control over all the economic information about that production. If you run through the Department of Revenue, there are those are tax, you know, tax information. There are different rules around privacy there. So we know what money was spent. I can tell you how much money was spent at a Target store in zip code 55436 by a production. It gives us good data to know whether this program is a good return for taxpayers or not. So at 25%, I honestly feel that we're very competitive with many of the other states, even those offering a tax credit at a higher rate, because for that reason. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
The value to producers also in a rebate is that they, generally speaking, if they have their ducks in a row and they provide their financials in good shape, and we work with them to make sure that they provide them to our office the way we want to see them, they will get that check much faster than they would see the return on a tax credit. So it's the time value of money for them too is favorable. They see their check faster, assuming that they meet the challenges that when we evaluate their financials. But generally, I mean, we've always called it Snowbait, but this is called the Minnesota Film Jobs Production Program. I mean, this is about jobs production. That's why we called it Snowbait, because we could never remember the whole name of the thing. But it's really about jobs, and when people say, well, the way it works, it's all about who you hire in Minnesota, it's all about where you spend your money in Minnesota, and they spend it everywhere. The $5 million figure for North Country was verified for us by the Department of Economic Development. I had an analyst look at their Bible, their financial Bible for the movie, and in fact, it was $5 million. And that's a huge shot in the arm to a smaller community, and we are all about trying to push production into smaller communities and help defray the costs of working remotely by giving them a little bit extra percent. You had one other question, and that's about our outreach. It's really challenging for us to make sure that everybody knows about Snowbait, although we really try. We're, of course, if anybody were to Google anything that would have the word Minnesota Film or incentive or any of that, they're going to we're going to pop up on the high up on the engine on the search engine. And we do try, and we also get with legacy funding, which is another part of our program that's directed right to Minnesota filmmakers. We are one of the components we're working on for the next cycle is to do a lot of outreach to new immigrant cultures, minority cultures, and also remote Minnesota, so that we are really making every effort we can so that everybody in Minnesota knows what's available in terms of grant funding.
Yeah, I apologize, ma'am, for mispronounce your name.
Ms. Winter. Right.
Winter. Okay. Yeah. And the reason I brought that up is because you know this program do trying to attract you know Hollywood production movie into our state, but at the same time we shouldn't overlook our independent producer who willing to spend much more money, and that way will enhance the quality of our production and employ create more job, you know, in our region.
Correct. Yes. And Mr. Chair and members, I would also just say that while we have experienced contraction in our we were a $300 million GDP in 2000 and we have shrunk now to less than 250, and that is directly the result of our not having an incentive over the last few years. But I will say this: we are very diverse. If, as you saw from the film, we have a cable, we have a national cable segment here that is making more than 30 national cable television shows. Bizarre Foods would be one that you'd all know. We have a vibrant commercial segment here. We have corporate video. Best Buy alone spends almost $20 million a year in the state making corporate video and video for the web. And we have independent, we have a very well-known 3D documentary producer who works here for National Geo. So it's a very diverse group. So it isn't, I would love to see Hollywood here, and with this appropriation we could do that. But we also can attract TV series with this kind of money, which are long-term jobs. And there, so we are really supporting what is a broadly based industry here with this appropriation.
Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few different questions. And I don't want to come off as a devil's advocate. I just am curious to connect some dots here, Senator Bonoff and Ms. Winter. So if I understand you right, it's not we think about it as filmmaking and Fargo and movies in the past that we've had in this area. But Grumpy Old Men, I think, was one of them. But you're saying it's beyond that in that it's TV series, it's cable shows. It's not just the movies in the box office. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yes. Film, as defined in this bill, means a feature film, television, or internet pilot program, series, documentary, music, video, television, commercial. So it's digital media, basically, all, whether on film, video, or digital media.
So the question goes through my head as you're talking about the rebate. And if I understood you right, Ms. Winter, there's about we've had contraction to about $250 million of activity from 300. What if we put this incentive out there? What guarantees actual increase in production in our state versus just the current ones that are all already here doing it for with no incentive from just deciding, hey, why not? Why wouldn't they want to just take up this incentive and this rebate, and we could have the same level of activity, but now it would cost us $10 million in an incentive when they're already here doing the job?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good question, and the answer to that question is that right now, we are in a position, because we do not have any general fund dollars for Snowbait, where we are not able. I can pick up the phone. I can go to L.A. and make sales calls. And the first question I get is, do you have an incentive? If you do not have an incentive, they're not going to come here. And even...
Bless you.
Even people who are working here now, for example, you saw Colleen Needles, who has tremendous entertainment. They are making about 12 shows right now. They are the Bizarre Foods franchise, which, and that's put us on the map all over the world. It's crazy how many people know Bizarre Foods. But they are being re-asked all the time by the companies they work with, so Discovery Channel or whatever channel it is that contracts with them to make the show. Why they want to see them working in states that have an incentive. So Tremendous has now opened an office in LA. So this is as much about our talent being cherry picked out of here to go elsewhere as it is about attracting new business. With the way this language is written, we have a Snowbait committee, which is a committee based on its volunteers who are professionals in these different segments, and they help us formulate guidelines every June. And when we formulate those guidelines, we are asking ourselves exactly the question you're asking me. How are we going to, we have a maximum of 25, but we could be offering some things 15. We don't have to offer everybody 20. So we are asking ourselves, how are we going to get the most bang for this buck, for this money? And we will craft the guidelines that way. The other thing that would happen immediately is now when I go and do sales calls, I have something to say. I have a 25% incentive and I have some dollars, and now I can, it's much easier for me to very quickly pull business into the state. Right now, I can go and call on them and I can be as charming as I want, and they're not coming here. I can tell them all about our great crew, which is absolutely true, our great locations, how close you are to greater Minnesota from the metro, the diversity of our seasons, the great airport, how we have 10 reasons to shoot here that we are always touting, but if we don't have the incentive, which I call the great, it's the red crayon, that's the one everybody wants. If we don't have that, I am not going to, in many cases at the larger studios, I don't even get a meeting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, I was joking about wanting my son to come here, but he recently was a producer on a film where it was a Minnesota young man's film, and it was chosen to be in South by Southwest. It got a great review. Miss Winter spoke to the director and writer of that film, and he specifically said that if we have this, he would do his next film here. And that's just one anecdotal example.
Sure. So the movie talked about us being the first ones in 1997.
Correct.
And now all of a sudden everybody's got it? I mean, did we actually start this Pandora's box, if you will?
I mean, now
40 states have it, and we're one of the 10 that don't, if I understood that right. I mean, that's just not that long ago. I came into the legislature in 1997. We funded this that first year. I think Senator Tomasoni was a representative at that time. Mm-hmm. So... Did I hear that right? And then let me ask a second question to that. There's also a list on your movie of several films in 04, 010 that were here. And so it is happening without this rebate.
Yeah.
But I think you partly answered this question before. But two parts of that question. I mean, is that right? It's just moved that fast to everybody offering incentives, or in 20 years ago nobody was?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, it is true that when in 97, and this was before my time at the Film Commission, but in 97, we were starting to see, because of our topography and our snow, we were starting to see productions that we would have expected to get in Minnesota moving to Canada, because Canada was, they have a lot of space and they had cities, they needed to put some people to work. And they started not only provincial incentives, these are tax credits, but also a national incentive. And they have been able to build Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal into very large production centers. I can't tell you how many TV shows, including Juno, well, TV shows and movies, including the movie Juno, were shot in Canada that were written for here. So the response to that was the film board went to the Capitol and got Snowbait, this legislation written. It was 5%. It was $500,000, I believe, the first year. And it worked. And I don't think anybody in their wildest dreams realize number other things were also factor other factors. Cameras have, over the last 10 years, and all the equipment has gotten smaller and easier to pack. So there's been a migration out of Hollywood to all four corners of the world for production, because you can now put your camera on an airplane. You're not dealing with film. It's easy to do. So there's been an out-migration from Hollywood, and Hollywood will probably never, they'll never get all of it back. New Mexico has just put up, they've just gone seeing kind of the light. They are moving to a 30% tax credit for TV series and leaving 25% for features, because they're finding that TV series offer longer-term jobs, high wages, and a lot of employment for locals. And that's something that I would want to be doing some serious sales on. It also puts your town on, or your state on the map in a huge way so these are all strategic questions once you get the money. What are you going to do with it? But to answer your question, yes, we were the first. And this whole thing has caught, this map, I think, is truly illustrative of how many states are in the game. Now, some of these are never going to be players. My view of this is that you need to become a regional center. Atlanta's becoming a regional production center. Portland is becoming a regional production center. And on the East Coast, you've got Philadelphia and New York. You can go back and forth by train, so people and crews do that. But we would, and Hollywood has got they put up $100 million incentive, and it was gone in one day. And that was because there is so much desperation. I mean, it's scary out there how many people are in trouble who've had great careers, because so much production has left Hollywood. So it is true that we started this. Yes, we did.
So I hear you're right. Basically, what we grew up with, thinking Hollywood was where all the films are produced, is changing. At a minimum.
Mr. Chairman, it is absolutely changing, and it will never go. It's never going to go back to the way it was.
Sure.
Never.
So, last question on this right now. You talked about getting to greater Minnesota. I mean, what's the reality that my district has the prospect of this? It seems to me that most of it's going to stay metro, or you call the outer ring counties, Carver or Wright or some of those counties just on the edge of the city, greater Minnesota, because
Center West from, there's nothing we can sell out there. That, you know, we got it wrapped up on the range if it's coming.
I think of this example, Mr. Chair, if anybody remembers a little history, Minnesota history, the movie called Herman, USA. Herman's in the center of my district, close to my hometown. It's the town with all the bachelors, if you remember that from 15 years ago. But the movie was actually
a bad movie.
Does anybody know where the movie was filmed?
Where?
New Germany, Minnesota. Because in the story I was told was it was they needed and wanted to be close to the metro for the film production, and so they actually didn't come to the town and film it. And so my concern would be, realistically, are we still just, and I don't know if it's a concern, realistically, are we looking at just the outer ring counties to the metro area?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I can answer that question. Another, that's a great question. And the answer in my experience is there's a push and pull. Some of the larger productions, especially independent films, are going to, they want to be true to their story. And if you can help them, especially with a larger incentive to defray some of the per diem costs and some of the costs of putting people up. The other thing is, in greater Minnesota, you can get really great deals on hotel and on catering and food. But what I'm finding is we have two films that are very seriously looking at the Iron Range for this summer. We have, when I was in L.A. in November, I met with a producer who wants to shoot a movie, and I hope he does, because it's an absolutely fabulous story, and he wants to shoot it in Duluth. It's based on the Edmund Fitzgerald and what would happen if the captain had lived. And it was a Minnesotan who wrote the book, a Minnesotan who adapted the screenplay. It's a fabulous movie. We would definitely want it here. So, yes, some producers are going to want to stay close inside what we call the zone. But often what they're looking for, and I get this more times than I can tell you, is they want a small town main street. That is what they're looking for, that is willing to play ball with them and be part of the production. And then in exchange for that, everybody gets on Main Street, sees a business year like they haven't seen in years. So there's some productions that are going to want to hover next to in the metro area, but there are a lot more and more now who are willing to go out because they're looking for, they need the setting, and they will go to that setting, especially if you can provide some kind of incentive. For example, North Country, which is a really good example, the only reason we got any piece of North Country was because the commissioner at the IRRRB at that time.
Commissioner?
It was the governor working with, she was, well, it was really the governor who
was it you, Senator Tomasoni?
Well, the commissioner tried to kill it, if you remember.
Yes, but she was overruled by the governor, there was an incentive involved in that film. And if we hadn't had an IRRRB incentive for that film, there would not have been any piece of North Country shot in Minnesota. And even though
it gets worse. I'll tell them what else happened, because what else happened was because we didn't have enough of an incentive, they filmed half of the film in New Mexico, and the bar scenes were actually filmed in New Mexico and not on the Iron Range.
Wow. Yeah, with all the Adobe.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Exactly. Right.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, and that is why we are trying to give a greater production credit if they go out of the metro, because we do want to drive jobs outside of the metro.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
that's the right answer.
It was a really long one, though.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Bonoff, just a question. I think it's sort of off of what Senator Westrum was talking about. So just so I understand, right now there is no fund. That in Section C, on page 2 from lines 2.19 to 2.25, that's all existing in statute, and we don't have these incentives at this point in time. So all the activity that was discussed, all of the production that was done, all was done without any government subsidies.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, there are legacy dollars that have flowed according to the rules of the legacy, but we have not funded the production credit program for quite some time. And there is data that shows for every dollar that you spend, you get a $7 return on that investment.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Bonoff. And it coming from the legacy fund makes it a little bit better. I mean, I hate to be a wet blanket here, but we have a $600 million deficit. We're going to add to that, or we're not going to help the situation by adding $10 million here. I appreciate the fact that this may be something that some people might want to agree to, but considering all of the facts and considering we're just taking $10 million and in essence sending it to Hollywood, I think Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have plenty of money on their own. Hate to be a cold blanket about the situation, but I just don't see this as a priority considering all of the production and all the activity that's going on currently here and that the legacy fund already has some funding from it. I guess I have to disagree with you on the $10 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, I completely understand why you would look at it that way. The thing I would say, though, is that they get up to a 25% credit having to spend at least $1 million here. And so this session, because of our deficit and because of our shaky recovery from the recession, I'm looking for what we can do to grow emerging markets, whether that be in the biotech area, whether that be in the arts, wherever there are pockets of talent and growth potential. I'm looking for ways to take $1 and make it 10 for the state of Minnesota. And so that's why I've signed on to this bill, not really because it's movies, but because they spend so much money when they come to town. Films are a little unique in that it's a short amount of time, and it's a lot of money. And so that to be able to bring that kind of resources here, and you say, Angela Jolie, she's not going to get that money. The money is going to the production costs that are spent here, not for, to put in an actor or actress's pocket.
It has to, and they look at the receipt. That money has to be spent in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I just respectfully disagree with you with your assessment of it. I appreciate having $10 million spent on Medtronic and for jobs that are long-term sustainable jobs. When a film comes to town for 5 weeks and takes $1 million subsidy from us, that's $1 million worth of taxpayers. When it's coming out of the general fund, it's taxpayer dollars.
Senator Osmek, I think you're misunderstanding how it works.
I mean,
this might be a political statement on your part, but I think you're misunderstanding. The company has to spend $1 million in Minnesota. And then they get a 25% rebate. So
right, and, but I'm saying it's. I just threw $1 million as a number. The simple fact of whatever dollars are coming from this from the general fund, going outbound to Hollywood, I think is a wrong direction to go. Whether it's $10 million, whether it's $1 million, whether it's $200,000, whatever the case might be. So I guess it's a difference of opinion.
I think the idea is to bring Hollywood here.
Well, right. But they're already here. Respectfully, Mr. Chair, they're already here. We just saw all of those activities. Bizarre Foods is a show that I watch way too darn much anyway. My wife tells me to turn the channel because she's tired of seeing Andrew Zimmern. But the simple fact of the matter is they're already here. That activity is already taking place. What this is to do is to incent more activity, from what I can understand. It's already taking place, and it could organically grow on its own without $10 million from the general fund. So I guess I disagree with spending it.
Okay, I'm not going to get into that discussion. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Ms. Winter or Senator Bonoff, I'm not sure. What's the reason for the change from administration to employment and economic development?
Mr. Chair and members,
I'm hoping it's the chair of the committee, but I'm just...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we did think that because this is a tool of economic development, that it's less about labor and more about using our economic development tools to grow an emerging industry.
Okay, good. All right. And the change on line 2.22 from production costs of $5 million to a minimum expenditure, is that just an easier thing to calculate, or is that...
Mr. Chair, members, we made that. Once we got this bill in and we're starting to show it to people in the industry, what we were hearing was, and this is absolutely true, we're more about what you spend here. A $5 million budget, we don't know, not all of that's going to be here because some of it's post-production. We wanted to make sure our goal with putting any kind of a cap or a floor on anything was to make sure that we're spending at least a minimum in our state. And at $1 million, people are going to be making a decent wage, and those are going to be union jobs.
Okay. Any further comments? If not, then we'll lay Senate file 352 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Senator Bonoff, you have one more?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Whenever you're ready.
Very good. Mr. Chair, this is Senate File 1093, the University Enterprise Laboratories. Very good. Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a bonding proposal, and UEL is a nonprofit bioscience incubator in St. Paul. It's located between St. Paul and Minneapolis campuses of the U of M. It is not a part of the U of M. It's a nonprofit corporation. It incubates small bioscience companies, many of which come out of the U of M. It's very important for us to capture these companies before they leave Minnesota. This UEL provides wet lab space that these companies need, and there is a tremendous demand for wet lab space, which is really something that we don't think about as we think about how we can make sure that companies choose to stay in Minnesota. The fact that they need very expensive high-tech places to be able to do their work. And so this is a creative approach where they literally use a shared services approach whereby they create a facility that can be shared by many startup companies who need a similar type of space to do their job. So many former tenants have outgrown the space and moved all over the state. Most of them are in the metro area. A number are closely tied to the Greater Minnesota Bioscience companies that directly support our agriculture industry. So what UEL is looking for is our assistance in actually finishing this project. They're requesting a $14.1 million appropriation to fund this expansion. The completed project would result in no ongoing operational costs to any unit of government. So, you know, with our bonding, we have a private match and then the public investment. In this case, they have completed raising and doing all of the private dollars, and this just allows them to finish this project. And so with that, I would turn it over to Jeremy Lenz, who's the chair of the board for UEL.
Okay, thank you. Just say your name for the record, and then
Jeremy Lenz, chair of the University Enterprise Laboratories Board of Directors, and with me today is Tom LaSalle, who is our real estate and finance expert as well, in case any questions arise. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Monoff for carrying this bill. This is a story that is an easy story for us to tell as volunteers on the board, and one that I am honored and excited to be talking with you about today. And hopefully what you hear is a jobs factory. And not only a jobs factory, but an industrial property that actually used to have tchotchkes for Garrison Keillor. It used to be Rivertown Trading, was the warehouse that UEL is located in at 1000 Westgate, which, if you think about that, 125,000 square feet of tchotchkes is a lot of merchandise. But what we think we represent is not only highest and best use, but we actually exceed highest and best use with the facility that we have there today in phase one. What the presentation is before you, the handout that you have in front of you, really tells is how bioscience jobs work, how complicated they are, as Senator Bonoff was talking about, how we're not only in a national competition, but we're in an international competition. But probably most importantly is that these jobs are very high paying. As you can see on one of the pages in there, $85,000 is the average bioscience job. And not only $85,000, but there's a high multiplier effect for each of these jobs.
We're having trouble here with tchotchkes.
Tchotchkes. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a Yiddish expression. It's like a little thing.
Excellent. I was wondering what it was.
Trinkets. Trinkets.
Translator.
Thank you. Doodads.
Right. Very good. Okay,
dust right. Collectors.
Okay, sorry.
NPR mugs. What we're excited about is that bioscience jobs represent very high-paying jobs, $85,000 plus on an annual average. But there's also a very high jobs multiplier into the local economy. And so you look at that from that perspective, and what you see is a project that exceeds highest and best use. So what we're asking for today is to join us in terms of completing the overall project. Today it's 124,000 square feet. We would like to add another 24,000 labs to make it 160,000 square foot facility. In today's facility, we have 285 jobs. We also have six graduates, as Senator Bonoff was mentioning. Those six graduates have ripple affected into the community 115 additional jobs. So the total jobs that have been that are active today in this community at an average of 85,000 plus the multiplier effect is 400 jobs. The other part of the story that I think is really important for us to tell is we've been fully leased since 2010. And when you look at it from that perspective, we actually have been turning down tenants that have been looking for wet lab space. We can't house them. And it's an interesting dilemma when you look at it from a real estate perspective. We are very encouraging as a nonprofit board of directors. We want more development in the area. We want for-profit businesses in the area. And even with excess tenants in the area, people have not been able to put together a for-profit business model because of how difficult these projects are to finance and how difficult they are to manage. So as a nonprofit board of directors, which isn't asking for additional operating dollars, we are here to this, asking the state for participation to complete the project and add another 24 wet labs to the facility. We believe that we can lease this up based on the tenants that have been approaching us, based on our working relationship with the University of Minnesota, which, again, We are not part of the university, but we are an independent nonprofit, but we work closely with the university to house some of their technologies. As we step back and look at this, one of the things that we asked for was the zip codes of all of our employees. Not our employees, but the 30 companies that are housed within UEL. And what you could see is a map that represents not the whole metropolitan area. And so then we step back and ask, well, what's their statewide? This is a regional project, but is this a statewide project? And so we looked at the companies that are represented within UEL. And one of the companies is a company called Centuron. Centuron is based on technology that comes out of Epitopics, which is part of Willmar Life Science. And so it's a greater Minnesota technology that needed to be located in the metropolitan area for its human application. And so we're very proud of our relationship with greater Minnesota entities and being able to make this a statewide project. So when you step back and ask, what does this mean for Minnesota's economy and where can we go from here, what we're really asking for is the continuation of what we have started and really what we think of as a flywheel of jobs into the local economy. So with that, I don't know if there are any questions that we could answer.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. I'm wondering, since this would be a subsidized facility, is there a term limit for a choice of, you know, I'd like to come up with better words than that, but like how long can a company stay there in subsidized space? And I'm sure you're going to say that most of them moved out, but do you have any that have been there, say, for 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator, fantastic question. It's one that we've been debating quite a bit. When I joined the board in 2010, one of the things that, as a standalone nonprofit in a very tough economy, the organization had to make a decision as when you look at incubators of this caliber, you have to have them as a region to be competitive in the biosciences. What UEL represents is an incubator that survived the downturn in the economy. When you balance that equation, 125,000 square feet is a lot of space to fill up. And so what the 24 wet labs facilities that we have, we also have office space around that. What we've been able to do in that regard, and specifically to the question that you're asking, we had to balance the real estate first and the incubation second. Part of the reason why we wanted to come to the state is to be able to shift that to be focused more on incubation instead of on the real estate side, because we have to have a balanced balance sheet at the end of the year. We have not asked for operating dollars from other entities. Other incubators around the country have actually gone under because they tried to be more incubator than they could be. So with that, as a board of directors, we've been able to graduate, even within that equation, we've been able to graduate 6 companies that have spun off in terms of that flywheel concept and created another 115 jobs in the community. What we hope we'll be able to do with the state participation is to push more towards incubation.
And more pointedly to the question, yes or no, do you have anyone that's been there more than 5 years?
I'll let Tom answer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the we have some office.
Say your name for the record.
Tom LaSalle. We have some office tenants that have been there longer than that. To specifically the incubator lab space, what we do with them is work with them to find alternative space. The challenge you have in the marketplace since the dot-com bust is the companies that we are graduating have gone to a level where they're successful in raising additional funds, but they are yet to produce any revenue stream. So they're not bankable. You can't take them to a landlord or to a bank and get them to make a loan. So what we've done is worked with the our graduates and with the landlords to come up with a scenario where they, in fact, can deal with it. In the last case, we were successful in negotiating a letter of credit with a landlord, so they would take the risk with our startup and go to the next step. So what we've been working on are methods to get them moved on, and are very aware of trying to be an incubator and not a home for somebody running a business. But they are very limited in size in the space. As they grow, they can't function in our labs.
Senator Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question on, and by the way, this is one I agree with. Can you explain, what are the other investments or investors that are involved in this project? I'm assuming you have some level of angel investing involved, because certainly having private partnership with public dollars, I think, is always a good thing. Can you explain any of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, address the question from the first phase of the project. We were successful in raising money from a number of other similar type corporations in the community. The university was a contributor. Excel was a very large contributor. And we were able to get new market tax credits. So those were the vehicles we used. I think you might also be asking, though, the kind of investors in the individual organizations or tenants come from a variety of funds, and we have seminars in the building where we introduce tenants to possible sources of mezzanine financing. There's some angel funds, as you've talked about, just all different varieties of fundings.
Any other comments or questions?
Okay. Mr. Chair, as I understand, the process is that it will be up to you to put together your list of recommendations to move on to the Capital Investment Committee. And so I'm just here to ask that this be at the top of your list.
Senator Bonhoff, that's why everybody comes in front of this committee.
I just want to make sure you can't, you got to ask for your vote. You can't just assume it.
I appreciate that. Okay, so we'll lay Senate File 1093 over for a possible inclusion and a recommendation to the Bonding Committee. Don't know if they'll be at the top, bottom, or in the middle.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff.
And thank you, members, for your time today.
And Senator Weber, we have until 5:30 to be in this room today if we need to. So just so you all know that I don't think Senator Weber's bill will take that long, but just I told him we'd stay as long as he needed it. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would assume if I took until 5:30, I would get some really dirty looks before that we were done. But
okay. Yeah, for me.
Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am glad to be here today to present to you Bill 914, or Senate File 914. As you recall, in the past number of years, the state of Minnesota has had an ethanol incentive program, and with payments to producers. Those payments are now done, and yet there are monies still coming in that are referred to as tails, of course, that have been designated to the Department of Agriculture, and I think the number that was quoted me is somewhat in excess of $10 million. And what we are asking for in this bill is for $2 million of designation to go to the various entities that are listed within the bill. And the reason that we have those entities listed there is that we felt that it was important to continue to utilize those monies to motivate, educate, train, and support our future ag leaders. It's important that we invest in ag business. I don't think there's any question about that, but we also believe it's important to invest in our future owners, employers, and advocates. As we look at the money that is intended here, you'll see that we include our young people through the 4-H and FFA programs, as well as MAILSEE, because they are in the process of giving grants to school districts to reinitiate agriculture education programs. We look at adult training in the through MARL and with the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership, or Minnesota Ag Rural Leadership, and as well as the Center for Rural Policy, ORI, which of course is we've had presentations on, and their involvement in development of new products and jobs in the ag economy, as well as Farm America, all designed with education and innovation in mind. I have with me today representatives of both MARL and Farm America. And at this point in time, I will turn it over to Dan Hoffman with MARL for a few comments. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Hoffman. Just say your name for the record, please.
Dan Hoffman, Executive Director of MARL, Minnesota Ag Rural Leadership. Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm proud to be a MARL alumni. So proud that I left my job of teaching farm business management of 23 years at Riverline Community College, and before that, high school ag in Montgomery, Minnesota, to become the leader of that organization.
Making more money?
To the contrary, I don't tell many, but it actually went a little bit less than what I was making.
We should talk later.
But I believed in the cause, and one of my class members, Paul Torkelson, actually was inspired enough that he ran to be a representative in our great state. He was also responsible when we were in Washington, D.C., during part of the two-year cycle of learning about leadership, agriculture, and civic engagement. He was responsible for getting some of Class 4 to drink wine with George and Laura Bush in an interesting place at worship. He said, let's go to this church on Lafayette. That's probably where the president will be. And regardless of whether you're Democrat, Republican, or something else, you have to respect the person in the office, and it was a delight. One of the highlights of my 2 years with that program. MARL, Minnesota Ag Rural Leadership, is about training people to be recognized, respected, relevant, and ready. When they're done with that two-year course, I hope that you will call on them to be people to help you leverage your skills, your time, and your communities. They know a lot about agriculture. On our website, www.marlprogram.org, we have the bios, we have the emails. You can go there and ask them questions about making ag policy. We learned when we were in South Africa studying apartheid and other issues how important policy is. You men, you gentlemen, you women make a big difference on what happens around the state. You make a difference whether we succeed or fail. By the way, Senator Sparks, on the way up, Jim O'Connor said to greet you. Apparently you were at his farm recently. We hope that you'll call on these people to visit their farms. Not all of them are farmers. Investing in MARL is a leveraged concept. Two-thirds of the funding comes from non-tuition. Each person pays approximately $5,000. The other $15,000 comes from places like CHS, Minnesota Corn Growers, Minnesota Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, soybean growers, pork producers, turkey growers. So you're leveraging your investment. You might say, why should we invest further? Because a lot depends on it. Why should I leave a comfortable job of 23 years? Because a lot depends on it. I really believe in it. You are leveraging, you're cooperating, you're partnershiping, and you're developing economic growth. Recently, we had a strategic planning session. We hired a consultant. We met at CHS. They donated the space. They actually donated the food. One of the things that came out of that strategic plan was we need to develop working with ethnic groups and minorities. How do we get them involved in our class? How do we get them on our board? We also identified that we need to move further into northern Minnesota. This week, on the 21st, we'll have a banquet in Bemidji.
I noticed there were no names in northern Minnesota here.
sir, is that our board?
Yes. There's one from Grand Marais.
Warren, how about Warren, Minnesota? Does that qualify as northern Minnesota?
Not sure where it is.
Warren would be in the northwest corner. Cam Fanfilik, okay, who works with the Northwest Development Corporation, is on the board. But that is one of our strategic plans, Chairman, is how do we approach northern Minnesota? We have John and Deb Shute, our alumni from Duluth area.
You have to have a passport to get across Highway 2 first.
We'll work on that. You mentioned we should visit afterwards about my salary. Let's visit about that as well. Doug Hoffbauer, Duluth, a truck farmer, vegetable grower, Christmas tree grower. He was just in New Zealand. Speaking of policy, we toured many dairy farms. They are growing their dairy industry. Why? Because their government embraces the growth and the policy of economic development, and they realize the value of agriculture. Not all our people are from rural Minnesota. We have some people from metro area. They're in Class 7. Class 7, as I mentioned, will be in Bemidji this week, learning about lumber, learning about natural resources, and leadership. We're actually starved for leadership in agriculture in some respects. Why? It used to be 100% of the people raised food, fuel, and fiber. Now, 2% of the people do it. They're busy doing their business, and we need to engage them so they can be advocates for Minnesota and agriculture. I heard somebody, I believe it was the Senator Weber, mention AURI. When we were in Marshall, again, we move around the state, 9 in-state locations, Washington, D.C., and also an international site. Many of these people have never used a passport before. That was my case when I was in the class. I'd walked into Mexico at Tijuana. I had driven into Barrie, Canada for a figure skating training session for my daughter. I'd never used a passport. And that was pre-9/11, of course. Now these people will use it. The last class came back from Morocco. What an interesting experience. They learn a new culture. But when we were in Marshall at SMSU, where I'm headquartered and have an office, the class met with AURI. After the class, and it stands for Ag Utilization Research Institute, one of the class members said to me, I've been thinking about developing a meat product on some of the livestock from my farm, buffalo. Do you think I could meet with ARI and they would help me develop that product? Absolutely, that's what they're for. Our state invested in a meats lab, a nice new one. Carissa Nath there does a wonderful job. Farm America, I personally was on Farm America's campus on several occasions. The most recent was I host a program called Farm Connections on KSMQ. It's a way of leveraging a small amount of money, a small amount of time, and letting people see the good things that happen. We were at Farm America for a safety camp. We partnered with Farm Bureau, Ruth Merrick, Jim Jekyll. Agriculture is dangerous. That safety camp, along with Jim Gibson, who's in the audience in the back, did a wonderful job of showing youth how to work safely on the farm. We have many, many cases of students coming back and their parents and saying, well, I can't run the lawnmower anymore after safety camp because when we went home, Dad said, no way. I'm a product of 4-H and FFA. Investing in the bill that Senator Weber has brought forward along with his colleagues perpetuates that. Without that, I believe our rural communities are disadvantaged. MEALC, Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, they also leverage the dollars you invest. I hope that you write down the website, again, www.marlprogram.org, and take a look. How can that organization help you? And with that, I hope you have a couple of questions. Otherwise, I'll feel like I didn't do my job.
Senator Scalzi.
I don't have a question right now, but I do have an amendment that I would like to propose that I've discussed with Senator Weber, but I'd like to wait until you're through with your testimony.
Okay. There's three W's in that URL, right? WWW?
Yes. Okay. Sorry.
All right. I'm just making sure because I thought I heard it twice.
Sorry about that.
Maybe the farmers had their own way of doing things, and so then I thought, you know, maybe I better ask.
And Chair, thank you for asking. Two-thirds of the class are actual producers of food, fuel, and fiber. One-third are people like Amy Klobuchar's aide, people that work in economic development, soil and water conservation, or businesses that serve agriculture. And really, that's what's fun about this is it's a melting pot. We take metro, we take agriculture, we take rural, we take all the people that are involved in our state in those enterprises and run them through the class. We visit their businesses. When they're done, hopefully they're more versatile, more able to communicate, and ready to be leaders. A person I think of when I think of that is Rick Smith. Rick Smith was a student of mine in farm business management near Adams, Minnesota. Since he's been in Marl, he stepped forward and he's been on the Minnesota Milk Board, selected to be on it. He's stepped forward and now he's a committee member or officer in the Minnesota Farm Bureau located in Maurer County. He's also on the Water Task Force Committee with Root River. Two of our alumni have served with the governor's task force on water quality. We think that this melting pot, whatever denomination you are, whatever party you come from, whether you're rural or agriculture, is absolutely imperative. They've also learned to work with minorities. Again, I wouldn't feel like I did my job unless I had at least one question.
Or you did a really good job and you answered all the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chairman. I also have with me today Mr. Tom Haggerty. He is with Farm America, and he has a few comments he would like to make.
Mr. Haggerty, please say
Mr.
your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Haggerty. I'm a board member of Farm America, and no, I'm not here to talk animal disease, which is what I usually am doing. I'm here to talk about funding for Farm America. Farm America has been in place now since the mid-70s, It's a rather unique interpretive center set up on 120 acres of land in southern Minnesota in the heart of the deep black soil. And it's a gift at that time from the farmer that, as a young man, I used to work with. At any rate, it has a timeline from the time of the sod huts in the 1850s to the present. And that timeline is a driving or walking path that lets people and students follow the development of agriculture in Minnesota. Many school groups are brought to this. Many adults come. A lot of functions that go on at this facility. And it's truly a way to understand where farming is coming from and where it's going to. As in the process, there are 27 buildings on this facility spread out along this timeline. And as you might expect, those buildings deteriorate and need a lot of repair, constant repair. We've got two very good staff people that are able to do much of the repairing themselves, but even the repairing takes material, and that takes funding. So with that, Mr. Chairman, it's simply a matter of looking for additional funding. The funding for Farm America has gradually decreased over the last several bienniums, and the hope would be that there would be some additional funding in order to at least get some maintenance for those buildings and improve it so it doesn't totally deteriorate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi, you have an amendment you want to discuss?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I believe there's an amendment that can be passed out.
Okay.
And what it would do, it would add more funding even to Senator Weber's proposal. And this amendment would add money to further the Forever Green Agriculture Initiative. And what it does is trying to diversify the economic opportunities in Minnesota and improve the conditions, including water. I'm carrying a number of water bills this year. And if members have no, this would be amendment, the A1 amendment. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment.
Well, let's talk about it first, because we're kind of short on members here today, and I'm not sure I feel real comfortable voting on this. But
okay,
Senator Weber, what's your opinion on this? If you want it in the bill, then I'll feel comfortable adding it to the bill. But I would feel uncomfortable voting on it if we're.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi. There were a couple of thoughts that entered my mind first. Number one, being an old farm boy, I'm certainly familiar with cover crops, and it's a principle that's been around for many, many years. And I look at that and probably think initially it probably belongs in the Ag College budget over in St. Paul, as opposed to funding out of this particular source of monies. And the second thing is, of course, from a selfish standpoint, I look at the bill and say, okay, is the bill going to be enhanced for its success to be included because of the inclusion of this, or is it going to drive the price tag up to a point where nothing is included? So I always have some concerns along that the line. The reality of it is, you know, when you ask, do I really want it to be included? I guess the honest answer is I don't think I do, but if it is the desire of the committee to include that, I'm not going to jump up and down and pound the table and say no, no, no.
That's probably a decision this committee has to make eventually here about the $10 million that we're talking about, because it is in the department's hands right now, and it's probably the job of the legislature to decide how it gets spent, but I'm sure that's a controversial statement that just came out of my mouth. And so I'm thinking that if we had a whole committee here, I would feel way more comfortable voting on this right now. But Senator Dibble, you had a comment, or did you just wave at me, or what was that?
Well, depends on whether or not we're going to vote on this amendment.
Huh?
I can hold on for time.
Is it on this amendment? Then it's not on this amendment.
Well, it depends on whether or not you want to call the vote or not.
Well, I think we can do this. I think we can lay the bill over for possible inclusion, and we can lay the amendment over with the bill, and that way we haven't voted on either one of them. And then we can have further discussion maybe when the omnibus bill comes out and decide what to do with it at that time. Because I know for sure we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and that should spark some interest and some debate out in the halls. And so this amendment would be a similar use of the money, and probably a meritorious use of the money also. I understand your concern that if we take too much of it, that then suddenly the whole thing falls apart. And I know that there's some people that don't want us to take any of it. So I think my initial instinct here is that with the amendments in front of us, we'll leave it in front of us, and we'll lay it on the table with the bill, and then we'll talk about what gets into the actual bill when the omnibus bill gets put in front of us. And if you have more testifiers, or are you good with what?
I don't believe Dr. Gibson is here anymore. Oh, there he is. Did you wish to say a few things? No. I guess this is James Gibson from Farm America, and if you just have a moment.
And members, I know we saw that Representative Hamilton's name was on the list of testifiers, and I told him that it's kind of a Senate custom to let representatives testify only if they're going to say something different than everybody else is saying. And so I figured he was going to probably just say more.
I understand, yeah, Mr. Chairman. Neither of us recognize that, and so
yeah,
that's fine.
So So I didn't want to mind it if he said something, but you know, we probably didn't need his testimony because you got some experts here anyway. So anyway, go ahead, Mr. Gibson.
My name is Jim Gibson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center at Farm America in Waseca. I would like to have had Mr. Hamilton speak because he can be quite passionate and very persuasive. But I'm really convinced that the inclusion of the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center in the bill is, and to have it financed is a very good use of state dollars. I've been the executive director for 3.5 years. My goal is to not leave it idle, is to grow, because we really need to meet the obligation that actually this legislature created for providing a place that is an ongoing source of information and immersion in respect to the economic, one of the important economic drivers for this state's economy, or this state. So agriculture is that it's about the history, it's about the present, but we'll see some things in the next short while that will also characterize what agriculture is doing in the future that all of us will be pleased with. You've all received a packet. I was going to just draw your attention to one of the items that's in there. It was the one on the left-hand side of the packet. There are two there and one on the other side, but the one that's on top. The back side actually has an aerial view. Early in the morning, don't see many vehicles during an event that we had last fall. But it gives you some idea of the 120 acres that Dr. Haggerty was referring to earlier.
Those space circles right there?
Yeah. Alien thing? There's a corn maze, that's for sure. And then we've been doing some harvesting and some of that as well. If you really look closely, had it magnified, you'd find there's some oats shocked in the background, and those were being harvested or threshed on that particular day. But no, it's not. It's not England. On the front page are the two things that we had mentioned in terms of we really appreciate the kind of support that state legislature has given to the governor's recommendations in the past for purposes of operations. This request, though, that we're talking about now is to go beyond that. Operations funding has not been sufficient to help us maintain and grow our potential. Inside, you'll see the list of members of our board of directors. Dr. Haggerty is listed there, of course, and a very valuable part of that. But some of you know Ed Frederick. Ed is retired from the university as of the end of December. Well, really, he's 82. And you've seen him, many of you have seen him many times. But I wanted you to hear what he would like to say about Farm America and why he's committed to it, so that's included. If you want to know how we're spending our money now, it's on the right-hand side of that open space in the circle diagrams, the income and so forth. That's probably more than you wanted to know, but I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members, and Mr. and Senator Weber.
And Senator Scully, did you want to say more about the amendment, or before I just lay it over?
Well, actually, just a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because it would maybe help with some of our natural resources. I don't know if you've looked at the St. Paul Pioneer Press. They're doing a week-long series of articles about the lack of water that we've got, not only in the metro but in the outstate Minnesota. And the perennial wheatgrass, I have a constituent who was working on this at the university, and he has approached me about this. He's saying we've got to get more of the perennials in the winter wheats. I mean, they've got a perennial wheat with long roots that's going to keep the soil in place and use less water. So there's lots of things that we can do to keep our farmers on the farm and help with our water problem in Minnesota at the same time. And I guess that's where this is headed. And it's just adding a little bit more money for the research, because they're working on the seeds for these perennial grasses that are, I think, maybe it could be the wave of the future to keep farmers on the farm and to protect our waters as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any last comments, Senator?
No, I thank you for Mr. Chairman and for hearing this. And again, I think these are very worthwhile projects that have been listed. And I'm certainly interested in visiting with Senator Scalzi more concerning her amendment. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, with that, we'll lay the A1 and the Senate File 914 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, thank you all very much. And with that, meeting is adjourned.